I don't know what's wrong, but I broke a broom today. Like, I just slammed it on the ground over and over until it snapped while my kids watched. And I told my friend this, and she was like, you're an addict. You're literally, this is how an addict behaves. And I was like, I think you're right, but the problem is I don't know what I'm an addict to. And she's like, it doesn't matter.
Before we dive in, just a quick favor. If you're enjoying what we're doing at Angels Among Us, please take a second to rate and review the show. And if something in today's episode touches your heart, please share it with a friend. Welcome to Angels Among Us, the podcast where we share real stories of angelic encounters. Each episode, you'll hear firsthand accounts of divine protection, guidance, and miraculous interventions that remind us we're never truly alone. Whether through a whisper of comfort, an unseen hand of protection, or an unmistakable presence, angels are closer than we think. Join us as we explore these powerful experiences of angels, both seen and unseen. Hello, hello. Welcome back to another episode of Angels Among Us. Brent and Michaela here as your hosts, and we are joined by Tess. We are super excited. I connected with Tess, it was really only about a week ago, I think. I've been following you on Instagram for quite a while, but I saw a reel that you put up that I thought would be perfect for the show. A lot of times when I reach out to somebody, I'll send them a private message. But I just commented just briefly on your thing or on the reel that you should come on the show. And then you said, yeah, let me know. So
yeah,
I thought that was very nice of you to respond. You have a much bigger following than we do. I'm sure when people of your following look at us, they're like, no chance. I'm not going to give you guys even a chance.
No.
So. You got to start somewhere.
It's true. And we all started somewhere, you know?
Yeah.
Yep. So we are thrilled to have you here. We're thankful that you've taken the time with us. And we just found out prior to recording that you painted your wall behind you by hand. So great job.
Yes.
Just
my
kidding.
Special paint from Wallpaper Direct.
Sorry, I say dumb things sometimes.
Hey, that would be a fun fact if it really was true.
I did paintbrush the glue.
Yeah. Okay. There you go.
I did have to do that.
Yeah, and you are good at that.
Okay, well, we'll turn it over to you, Tess. Go ahead and give a brief introduction and
Then
get going on what you'd like to share with us.
Yes, my name is Tess Frame. I live in San Diego. I have three sons and a husband, and we are just living the California lifestyle. And when my youngest son was, when I was pregnant with my youngest son almost 7 years ago, I got sick with the flu in late pregnancy. And the flu is a respiratory illness. And so I got, it just advanced, and you're so crowded internally when you're pregnant. So it's hard to cough effectively, which is essential for getting better, is getting that fluid out of the lungs. And so it turned into pneumonia, and then it turned into sepsis. And then I went into just full like organ failure and premature labor. So this had been like 8 or 10 days of illness, just progressively worsening. And I ended up going to the hospital with labor. I was like, shortness of breath was so bad for several days that I was sleeping sitting up, like I couldn't lay down or I couldn't breathe. That should have sent me to the hospital, but I didn't know. And so I waited, and labor started, because when mom's body starts shutting down, it's like, evacuate. Mom's not going to make it. We got to get the baby out. So I started going into premature labor, and I went to the hospital for that, thinking like, oh, you know, I'll get better, because that's what happens when we get sick. We always get better. Maybe tomorrow it'll turn around. And they saw me and saw my blood oxygen levels and my shortness of breath. And they were like, first of all, this woman is in distress, and the baby is likely going to have cerebral palsy because her blood oxygen has been in the 70s for several days. So, if you don't have any kind of medical knowledge about that, it's supposed to be at 100%, or like 95, between 95 and 100% is optimal oxygenating operation for your body. So when you're in the 70s, it's obviously not doing great. And then you know, your baby's getting all your blood from your sharing all of that. And so they were really worried. So they admitted me immediately and put me under general anesthesia. And I was thinking, like, they're just going to, I have no memory for like 4 or 5 days before this point. So I don't know what I thought they were going to do, but I think I just thought they'll fix whatever they need to fix, and then I'll get better, and then I'll just carry on in the pregnancy. But they ended up delivering the baby while I was in an induced coma. And it took about 4 weeks almost for me to be able to breathe without machinery. So I was on life support for 3+ weeks. And then when I woke up and realized where I was and what happened, I realized I wasn't pregnant anymore. And so it was this very like jarring, emotionally traumatic, plus physically traumatic thing that I had gone through. And you come to terms really quickly. As soon as you're, you know, you, all of the stuff that is happening to you in the hospital sort of turns you into a child, because you don't have a ton of autonomy or understanding of what's happening. But as you start to wean off of the sedatives and the narcotics and all the other things that they've got you on, you start to realize what is actually going on, and reality sort of sinks in, and you can kind of accept and comprehend what has happened. So it took a couple days for me to get there, but then I realized, okay, I'm okay. He's okay. Baby's okay. He's not here. You know, just starting to digest everything that we've been through in the last month. And they sent me, this cool thing happened where they downgraded me from ICU. They wanted to see certain like breathing milestones. They wanted me to be able to walk on my own. You have like full body atrophy, just super, super weak. I tried taking my first shower in the hospital and I couldn't lift my arms to wash my hair. Like the simplest actions that we take for granted were impossible for me, because my body had been just completely unused for so long. So I...
Do you remember all of this at this point?
That part I do. So yeah, once I woke up, I have kind of logged away most of what happened. I think some of it is probably spotty just from residual medication, but I think when it's so traumatic, you either forget it completely or you remember every detail. Mm-hmm. And so I like logged all of this away, and I remember it pretty clearly in the hospital. And they wanted to see certain milestones before they could downgrade me out of ICU. And I was very, very motivated to downgrade, because I knew I hadn't seen my kids. And they don't let children into the intensive care unit because it's a health risk for the patients and the children. So I knew, I was like, I haven't met my baby yet. I haven't seen my other two kids for almost a month. What are they thinking? Like, do they just think I'm dead? What do they think? And so I was so driven to, I was like, you write a freaking list on my whiteboard and you tell me what you want to see. You want to see me have a certain blood oxygen level? Like, I'm going to breathe deeply. I'm going to make sure that I hit those numbers, right? As if you have control over every single thing like that. But I actually did start meeting those milestones pretty quickly. Once they were like able to quantify them, I was able to work hard because I knew what I wanted to work towards. And when I downgraded to the progressive care unit from ICU, I was able to have my baby come visit me. He couldn't stay, but I got to meet my baby. I think it was a day before his due date, and he was 4 weeks old. So wow. It was this amazing, really heartbreaking moment where I held him for the first time, and I just was weeping. And it was so hard because I knew that I smelled so different. Like, I don't know if you've ever been around a hospital patient, like a long-term hospital patient, but they don't smell like normal. They don't smell familiar. They smell like the hospital or like the drugs or like the feed bag. I don't even know what it's called. The feeding tube, like formula, basically, that they, you just don't smell normal because you're not eating food. You're not going outside. You're not bathing. They're wiping you with like wipes. So I was, and I know part of newborn bonding is like how they smell, how you smell, the sound of your voice. And because they know the sound of your voice beforehand if you're pregnant with them. And I was like so devastated because I had been trached and I couldn't speak. So I had a hole in my neck to force oxygen into my lungs. And I couldn't, I was like, he's not going to know that it's me. He can't smell me. He can't see me. They can't see anything when they're that little. And I can't even talk. I can't sing him a song. I can't tell him I love him. And so I'm just sitting there like weeping, like I'm holding this baby that I, you know, and kind of the paranoia, the hospital paranoia of the situation is like, are we sure he's mine? Like, are we sure though? So I'm like devastated holding my baby for the first time, but it was kind of a miracle because it just like woke up this drive, this like maternal drive in me to like get better immediately and return to my kids. And so I ended up having a cool thing happen where they went home. I was devastated because I had to watch my sweet baby leave the hospital while I stayed in the stupid, uncomfortable bed. They wouldn't even let me lay all the way flat. They made me lay at a 30% incline. So I was so uncomfortable. So it was the worst. It was the worst. And all the while, once they downgraded me out of ICU, they cold turkey took me off of everything that I was on. And I didn't know what I was on. So I didn't know how to ask to be weaned. I didn't know anything. But I started having withdrawals in the progressive care unit. And I would get these waves of extreme agitation. Like I can't sit still. I feel like I gotta jump. I feel like I gotta like run, but I'm not strong enough to run. I can't even stand. I'm a fall risk. So I'm not allowed to get out of bed. And I'm like weepy and angry and I'm questioning everything. And I feel like they're trapping me here. It's like all these things are happening because I'm withdrawing from everything. Plus the, you know, the actual legitimate trauma of the situation. And, but seeing him leave the hospital and feeling this crazy drive to come home was so motivating. So then the next day I had to have it's called a barium swallow test, where they give you like some little food like yogurt or something or applesauce with barium mixed into it so that they can x-ray you while you swallow to make sure that you're not going to aspirate the food again, which is common after you've been trached. So they were like, you can't, like, you know, you can leave, but they were like, we don't want you to leave until we know that you're not going to like go home and choke to death. No. So I was doing this barium swallow test with this x-ray like against my neck, and I came back to the room and they had like disconnected all my oxygen and brought me down, and then they brought me back up and they hooked up my oxygen again, and then my kids came back to see me and a couple hours went by and then they left, and I just was feeling like, okay, I'm ready. I feel like I like, and they're saying like, we think that you probably don't need to stay in the hospital. You can probably go to like a rehab facility, like a medical rehab for, I don't know, like maybe even just 2 weeks. And I'm like, yes, because I'm thinking this is like a life sentence, you know? So they're like, yeah, we could probably get that figured out. We just need to make sure that your oxygen's doing really well. And so they came in to check everything and they were like, yeah, it's looking really good. And then they looked and they realized whoever had wheeled me back in from the barium swallow test excursion did not hook up all of my oxygen again. And I had maintained the proper numbers without assistance for like hours. So I was still very weak, but like functionally, I was breathing. There was no risk of choking and no risk of suffocating. So they were like, you want to go home today? By the end of the day. And like in the morning, they were saying 2 weeks in a facility, and I was happy about it. So then I get to go home But it's like, okay, now we're home and it's super unexpected. And you've just gone through this massive medical trauma that is going to like, it's a lifelong emotional impact. They didn't know if there would be a physical impact for me or the baby. And the mental game of healing from a trauma like this. So when I came home from the hospital, immediately, first night, I had like crazy night terrors, like waking up screaming. And my parents were there. It's hard. I'm like emotional and also like trying not to laugh because it's so extreme. It feels like a cartoon. It's like so insane. So my mom had basically moved in with my family and was helping take care of the kids and the baby while I was gone. And my dad had come down to help bring me home from the hospital. And so both my parents are there and they're taking care of the kids and the baby through the night. And they said, yeah, we heard you screaming like all night. And it just is like this fear that they're going to come and get me. They're going to bring me back. They're going to make me go back. Like they're going to take me away from my kids again. And plus all of the physical stuff that you aren't necessarily like consciously aware of, but I think you are subconsciously aware of a lot of the invasiveness of what happens in that situation. Especially for me, it was a post-birth situation. So it's obviously very intimate. It's personal, a lot of stuff that's going on. So right away, first thing off getting home from the hospital is like tons of night terrors, lots of withdrawal symptoms, lots of the agitation waves, shakiness. But the physical recovery was pretty miraculous. Like within a couple days, we had ordered, like when I came home from the hospital, they were like, hey, you probably need like a bedside commode, which is a toilet that you sit on in your bedroom. Humiliating. You probably need a shower chair and probably like a walker. So we bought all this stuff. And within 2 or 3 days, I was walking alone. Like I'm like, I don't need any of that. I'm 29, you know, at the time. I'm like, I'm 29. I'm strong. There's no reason for me to not regain my strength very quickly. And I think the reason they were telling me like, this is what you can expect is because most adults with this adult respiratory distress syndrome are like 75 plus. So the healing is much slower. The survival rate is very low. And it tends to be something that is seen more in like elderly who are like sedentary, not moving a lot, not exercising a lot. Where my situation was like, maybe I was a little more sedentary because I was advanced pregnancy. But for them, like, there's no real long-term reason that I shouldn't recover quickly. So the physical recovery really was very miraculously fast. And I think it really was driven by this feeling of needing to be with my children again. Like, I just was like, absolutely not. You're not going to keep me away from them for one more minute. So
how old were your other two kids at this time?
5 and 2 almost 3.
Mm. Oh my gosh.
So they were little, and my second son, who was 3 at the time, or almost 3, he doesn't really remember anything, but my oldest does. And I can tell in some small ways that it impacts him. And funny enough, I can see in my baby, just since we raised, you know, he was a baby like through the COVID years. This happened in 2019. So he turned 1 right before 2020. Like he turned 1 in March 4th, 2020. So it was like, then, you know, then COVID happened a week later. Mm-hmm. And we spent a year in the house. And I can see little things that are like, maybe this is because of that kind of COVID isolation, but maybe it's because of that traumatic birth. So, but I can see little things where it's just like, he's a little bit more, it was harder to bond with him because of that initial separation. Mm-hmm. And I actually consulted some friends of mine who had adopted babies, and they had said, yeah, you can bond. You can bond the same. It's just a little bit more of a manual process. It's less biological. It's not happening on its own because, you know, your milk has gone away. You've had so much chest radiation for your lungs that, like, you're not going to nurse him. So you're going to bottle feed, but you bond. You bond with a bottle. You guys are adoptive parents, you know. So I just had to kind of have this totally new experience with, like, bonding with a baby post the 30 days of, you know, newborn euphoria. So for about a year, those really intense, like level 10 post-traumatic things went away quickly. The withdrawal symptoms went away quickly within probably 2 months. But, and I have explained this on my Instagram account recently, which might be the post that you saw, where addiction to anything is not literal dependence on that drug. It's that that drug has taught your brain to not be able to function without it. So I'm not like, oh, I'm craving it, I want it. It's that my brain has been basically rewired to think that I'm never going to have to deal with pain again. Cause that while that drug is in your system, it's like, I've got it. You don't need to worry about this. In fact, I'm so good. You don't ever need to worry about this again. And so these, you know, what I'm specifically talking about are these, I don't know what the sedatives were that I was on, but those plus synthetic opioids. I was on fentanyl and Percocet and morphine, just a whole cocktail, a rotating cocktail. And I think just the intensity of what was happening maybe necessitated that. I don't even know, but it caused I almost want to call it brain damage. Like, it causes neural pathways to stop operating the way that they should. And you form new ones according to, like, this dependence on this substance. So it wasn't like it was my choice to start using these things recreationally. And then gradually it was like immediate emergency, probably would have still had this happen even if I had only been on them for like a couple days, because they're so potent and they're so effective. So in the year following, those withdrawals went away quick, but that year following, I lived in kind of a euphoria state, but I was very sensitive, very easily stressed, and like living in a heightened state of stress all the time. And at that year mark, it like notched up to like level 10, that stress state. And I would say that was when it really kicked into, I should have dealt with it sooner. It was already post-traumatic stress disorder before this, but this is when it was really like, there's a problem, you need help. So in the recovery movement, we call it unmanageable. So my life became unmanageable. Myself became unmanageable. And I had to get help that I didn't know that I needed. I'm like, I don't know what's wrong, but I broke a broom today. Like, I just slammed it on the ground over and over until it snapped while my kids watched. And I told my friend this, and she was like, you're an addict. You're literally, this is how an addict behaves. And I was like, I think you're right, but the problem is I don't know what I'm an addict to. And she's like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter, because we're never going to encounter that drug again, on purpose at least. So it's not like, oh, now we wean. You've already weaned. You need to fix the neural pathway now. And she recommended that I go with her and her husband. Her husband was also a recovering addict.
Does she know all that?
Okay. She was an addict too, and he was 10-year sober alcoholic. So they were this couple who was close friends of mine. They're in their 60s. And she just was like a friend. She's just a buddy of mine. And I just was venting to her, like, I don't know what's wrong. I don't know what's wrong with me. My kids are afraid of me. Something's wrong. Something is not right. And she was like, yeah, something's wrong. You need to come to a meeting with us. And so I went with them to an addiction recovery meeting, a 12-step meeting. And it was, the first meeting I went to was so, so sweet and moving and very, very uplifting. And I saw other people, I didn't have a full understanding of the steps or the program, but I saw other people who were more affected than me really, really trying. And I was like, okay, this is reframing what I'm thinking of addicts. You know, if you've lived a sheltered life, our idea of addiction and addicts is like, you've done this to yourself. You chose this. You sought this by abusing something. And it's like, no. Nobody chooses addiction. Addiction is a monster that has you around the throat. And sometimes it has you around the throat for the rest of your life, even if you've never touched it again, you know? So I'm seeing these people who are the humblest, most connected to the Savior people that I've ever witnessed, sharing their stories of how they were able to use the atonement of Jesus Christ to give up their sins and their sorrows and their suffering, which is addiction, 100%, sin, sorrow, suffering, and really find healing, or at least be on the path to healing because of the atonement and the program. And it gave me an environment where I felt safe to, because, you know, when I confide in my friend, I broke a room today. I threw a small table. I threw a couch side table at the wall and I put a hole in the wall. Like, that's shame. That is shameful. And you're kind of afraid when you confide, if you confide in the wrong person, are they going to take my kids away from me? I'm not hurting my kids, but like, what if I do, you know? And so you kind of, there's this fear that this, you can feel that the monster is getting bigger and stronger and wanting to come out more. And I'm like, I can't control it. It's this, none of this is a choice. Like, if it was, it would have gone away, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was able to follow this 12-step program, which is so, so inspired, and find a lot of the healing that I needed from this. And this has been, like I said, this was 7 years ago, and I actually did not feel until last June, 2025 was the month that I was like, I think I fixed it. I think the monster is, I don't know if it'll ever be all the way gone, but I think it's as small as it can be. And I definitely have it. I am holding the monster now. He is not holding me. So it was kind of a long process of realizing how to help myself, how to get the help that I need and the support that I need. And, you know, the 12-step program is not the only component of that. Some of that is therapy. I went to EMDR therapy. I fixed hormone imbalances that the hospital trauma had caused. Overproduction of adrenaline causes imbalances in your progesterone and then your estrogen, and then your period gets messed up, and then you've got weight gain that you can't get rid of, and then the weight gain causes other problems, and you're pre-diabetic, and it's so every part of your body starts to, like, it's like a snowball. It's like an avalanche of physical and mental problems due to one traumatic event. And so kind of learning this and following this process took so long to figure out, but I feel like the program plus a lot of the other follow-up, just staying on top of it and really seeking the Savior, seeking happiness, seeking mastery of myself, have all been just key components to living a really joyful life. I like the phrase being a master of myself, because that means that, you know, I don't know that I'll, you know, like I said, I don't know that it'll ever be gone. I will always probably, not always, but I will probably have little disconnects in my brain that will show themselves for the rest of my life. Not to say I won't ever be able to control them, but, you know, there's damage that's done from these events and these drugs. So anyway, that's kind of my healing process.
Wow. How was your husband throughout all of this? I would love to know that.
That is the probably first question that everybody asks, because it's like, wow, what was he going through? We decided that first year we were not going to have any more kids. He was like, yeah, we're not doing that again. So I think that it was its own kind of trauma for him, because he's, you know, almost made a single dad with a newborn baby. He brings a newborn baby home from the hospital by himself while his wife is still in a coma. And he's just trying to keep it together so that the kids don't feel scared or stressed or like, you know, not lying to them, but also like, how do you tell them that mommy's still sick? Like,
yeah.
And I came home from the hospital, and like, this is just a little side note about how the kids were affected, but you don't always realize. We had these like piles of kids' schoolwork and little drawings and things. And I was looking through it when I got home from the hospital, and I found a drawing that my oldest had done. And it was, it's me in the hospital and I'm cut in half. So it's like a magician, like it's two upper half and lower half. Because oh, I had a C-section.
Yeah.
And so like his little baby brain was like, oh, they cut my mom in half.
Oh, bless his heart.
I know. Oh, and so I'm like, gosh. Oh, I hope that doesn't like mess him up for life.
Oh, bless her.
Do you know if when you were in the coma, if they brought in your newborn to like try to get him to bond with you at that point or anything, or did they not?
He couldn't. I was in the ICU immediately after birth, and they actually, because they had been worried about brain damage for him, they had rushed him off to Children's Hospital. So they actually separated us and we went to different hospitals. I know. So it was pretty crazy. And my husband was juggling visiting, like he was in a bubble room, the baby. And so he's visiting baby in the bubble room. And then he comes to the other hospital and he visits me. So he was doing probably like 6 hours of hospital time plus driving every day. Like it was so, so much.
Hopefully he got time off with his job.
Yeah. Luckily we're startup folks. So we're always kind of working with friends who are really flexible and understanding of that. So that was good.
That's awesome.
So I wanted to share a couple of times throughout this process where I noticed angels in the wings. When I remember coming out of sedation and starting to comprehend what was happening and where I was, and I remember thinking, my family's okay. And I think that I thought that because I am part of a strong church congregation that just really steps in. They bring meals, they babysit, they drive. My mom is blind. So when she would come to the hospital, she needed a ride every time. And people from my ward, my mom's not in my ward. My mom doesn't go to the same church in the same area as me. She lives an hour and a half away. But strangers would take my mom to visit me in the hospital an hour away and just do this service because they knew that our family was struggling and needed the help and needed the support. And I think I just felt right away. I just knew, because I knew that also just from my own experience, when somebody in my congregation is suffering, we step in, we do something. That is the Christian way, you know? So I think that I just really had a lot of trust that my fellow people would hold us through that time. And I felt very cared for. When I came home from the hospital, there was one, probably on the, I don't know, second or third day that I was home, and I was laying on the couch, and some people from a neighboring congregation, this wasn't the one that I went to, but it was one nearby, had volunteered to send some women to come clean my house. And I remember, if you've ever had someone clean your house in front of you. It's so embarrassing. It's very hard. It's hard to let them. It's so humbling because it's not even that my house was like so filthy and I was so embarrassed by it. It's that I'm laying on the couch while somebody mops in front of me.
Yeah.
And I just am like, let me get up and help you, but I can't.
But, you know, I also feel like in those times, like, it's also, we have to remember that we are actually needed too. Like the people that were helping you, like that was probably the best thing for them, you know, to be able to know that they were a help. And I think it's hard for, I mean, especially I'm that way. Like it's so hard for me to ask for help, but I love being needed. And I think that that's like a principle that we can remember in those times.
Yeah.
Like, hey, people love to help and it's so important to let them.
Yeah, service is a blessing for everybody, not just the receiver. Totally. So that was a moment where I was laying on the couch and I'm watching this woman who I don't know clean my house, and I just was like, "Oh my gosh. This is so moving and so hard. It's so hard, but it's so moving." So that was another one, and then obviously my addict friends who recommended the course of action for how to start recovering. They absolutely were angels. And the wife actually has become an angel since then. Oh. So she's our angel. I was with her when she passed and I got to say goodbye to her in the hospital. It was like, nobody ever gets that kind of closure when a friend passes away. But I was with her and I got to say goodbye and I told her, "Will you come and knock something over at my house so that I know it's you?" And she did. It was crazy. It was so crazy.
How soon after?
It was like a week and a half or 2 weeks after she had passed. And I was home alone. And I was like walking across. I have one long hallway in my house. And I was walking, like, my house is kind of a T-shape. And so I was walking past this long hallway. And I hear this ruckus in the back bathroom. And I'm like, what is going on back there? This is because no one's home. And a bunch of shampoo bottles had like fallen over. And I just looked around and I immediately was like, "Brenda, what are you doing?"
That's so awesome.
That is awesome.
That's really cool to remember her by. It's amazing.
There's a couple things that you talked about too that really kind of struck a chord in me. When you mentioned brain damage as an addict, I don't think I've ever thought of it that way. You know, because when you hear the term brain damage, you think of some...
You think physical trauma.
Right, right. But that makes total sense that, yeah, your brain isn't functioning. There's something that happened that literally damaged your brain.
And how it optimally operates. Yeah.
Right. And for me, like when I think about it that way now, it can help me to have a little bit more grace and understanding. I mean, I think you mentioned also about how when you think of an addict, you know, we have all of these preconceived thoughts or whatever. And honestly, a year ago, I would have been in that same boat where, you know, I'm a UPS driver and sometimes I'll be out and I see a homeless person or somebody that's clearly not in their right mind, you know. And now after having started the podcast and we've had, you know, a few people that have struggled with addiction and stuff on, and just the amount of love and grace, I'm just able to love people differently. And with what you said with the brain damage, that's just another thing, I think, to help me try to understand them a little bit better.
So. Yeah, for sure.
Well, I think these little pieces, Brent didn't mention either, but I have family members who have suffered from addiction, and Brent does too, a cousin. And definitely I love being able to hear people who have gone through that, because, again, it does... I don't know, allow you to have a little bit more of an understanding and grace with them. Because like you said, it can carry throughout. Maybe they're not addicted now, but it does affect their whole life. And we have seen that and it has.
Yeah.
So
I think what was something that made me feel like I really wanted to maintain control of the addiction was that I also have family members. Two of my mom's brothers have been addicts for, you know, since their early teens in the 70s. And just seeing how it has, they've like either lost everything or they never were able to achieve it in the first place. They don't have families, or they had families and they lost them because of the addiction. Or they cannot regulate their moods and they're really hard to be around. Or they're, you know, one of them has kind of, I think it's called like alcoholism induced dementia or something, where it's like it's at the point now where it's like if he quit he would still have it, because it, like we were talking about, it causes brain damage, and it's the substance itself causing brain damage in that instance, but for you know what we were talking about, it was it's more the rewiring of the neural pathways. But I saw this growing up, and into adulthood I've seen my uncles have a lower quality of life because of it, and have not be able to unlock the level of joy that I, first of all, think that I like, that I want, but also that I think we deserve. Like, everybody deserves a loving family and a safe place and a healthy body and brain. And what we don't realize is that those are things we work for. Those are things that are not, like, you don't just get that. You know, anyone who has children, it's like, even you get children, you get amazing children, but it's still hard. You get an amazing spouse. It's still work. You still have to work to make a great marriage. And so to have full control of myself and my mind and my perception of reality, just, I could see that starting to slip, because I, for me, the side effect was mostly like rage. Like, I just was angry and so stressed. I can't even, the word stressed is like, it makes people think of like spreadsheets or like traffic, right? But mine is like fire. Like, you're in a burning house. That level of stress is not the same as like a long commute, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's like blades flying at me. Like, I don't, but we use the word stressed for both of them. So it's like, I'm feeling this extreme level of like fight or flight all the time, you know? So, and I just could see that in that state, if I let it control me, it A, gets worse, and B, becomes something that is going to ruin everything else. It's going to ruin everything else in my life, because there are blades flying at everything. Mm-hmm. And one of them's going to break a window, or one of them's going to, you know, ruin my marriage, or one of them's going to hurt my kids, or what, you know? So I'm just like, no, I am not going to allow whatever issue is happening inside my brain. And it's all electrical. It's all just electricity going to the wrong place. And when it clicked for me that, like, you can actually take the electricity in your brain and choose to make it connect to a different point. It's work. It's hard. It's really hard. It takes a lot of therapy and a lot of self-discipline and a lot of practice, but you can like change your world experience, your worldview and your life experience, the way that you're experiencing and perceiving everything around you, just by deciding to fix it and getting the help that you need in order to do that. I don't mean to make that sound like you can just will away addiction. I just mean, like, I saw myself losing control because of this, and I wanted to reclaim that.
So what would be your biggest piece of advice for, I mean, we could go a lot of different ways, but thinking about family members who have gone through it, like, there's nothing more that I want for them to be able to get through the hard times, even if they're, you know, not addicted per se. Like, what's your biggest piece of advice for family members like, going through it and the person.
Man, well, I feel like, why aren't we learning the 12 steps in church? If we look at the 12 steps as a set of steps for us to go through as we access the atonement, if we look at it as like the 12 steps of the atonement, and you're actually learning how to give your sins, sorrows, and suffering to Jesus Christ. It's not learning how to fix them yourself. It's learning how to give them to someone else because you don't have control over all of it. If we look at that atonement process and these 12 steps as part of gospel teachings, which I firmly believe that they are heavenly inspired, they are totally designed to improve the lives and souls of the people who use them. If we look at this like almost like a church curriculum, it helps. It helps everybody. And it helps, it doesn't only help the addict. It helps, it can help the family. It can help if you have adult children or parents or anyone, spouses, friends. And I feel like because it's not teaching yourself how to give up a substance. It's teaching yourself how to give up your problems. And everyone has problems. So I feel like this program really, we should be learning this in church.
I have one more question before our final question. And speaking on the atonement, you mentioned that a couple different times. If there's somebody out there, a listener, who maybe they know what the atonement is, they know that Jesus died for them and suffered for their sins, but they don't necessarily know how to use the atonement in their life. How do we take those steps to really allowing the atonement to work in our lives?
Well, it's going to be different for everyone. I think we all have different communication styles and how we pray and how we talk to the Lord. So for me, I'll tell you how it went for me. For me, it looked like, first of all, praying fervently and saying, I am suffering and I know that you can heal me. Will you please take this thing that is causing me pain and help me fill that whatever hole is left behind? Help me fill that hole. And will you help me? And then asking specifically, like, will you please help me to be more patient? Will you please help my children to recover from how scary this year has been? Will you please, asking for very specific blessings. He's not on a budget. You can ask for whatever you want. He's not on a budget. He won't always give you exactly what you want, but you sure can ask. And I don't think, I don't think you asking to heal is going to hinder his plan. I don't know why he would withhold those kinds of blessings. So I feel like when you, for me, accessing the atonement really looked like a lot of prayer, a lot of identifying what I needed help with and then asking for that help. And I think just practicing being better. And when we slip up, we know return to your knees and just ask for help again. But when you succeed, if you notice it and you're like, you helped, you did it, you helped me. Or like, I didn't feel afraid today. Oh my gosh, you filled whatever was in me, that hole that was just like a black hole of fear. You're helping fill that in. I noticed it. And like noticing that things are getting better, I think that specifically really helps to rewire the brain, because we do get stuck in these patterns of like, this thing keeps frustrating me. There's Legos everywhere and I'm stepping on Legos and it's so triggering. And it's like that, if that's the thing that sets you off. But it's like, if you notice, there are still Legos everywhere and I loved it today. And I appreciated that, like, my children feel safe enough to leave their Legos out. And, oh my gosh, I got a break from the kids today and there were no Legos out. Like, whatever the blessing is, start looking at everything as a blessing. And it really does help rewire those neurons in your brain to, I'm obviously not like a neuroscientist. I'm speaking as somebody who has done the manual work only for myself. I cannot speak for anyone else, but this was my experience with just learning to find joy again was like start looking for it and identifying it.
Oh, love that.
Yeah, well, I can speak for both of us and all of our listeners that we are so happy that you have that monster by the throat. And
gosh, give me chills.
Yeah, it's, I just love to see people shine so bright, especially after having gone through something traumatic. And we've all gone through traumatic, difficult things. So thank you so much for shining your light and for being willing to share and talk about it. It means a lot.
Thank you.
And what hope, oh my goodness, it's giving people.
Yeah, so Tess, last question. We would love for you to share one thing that you know to be true.
Okay, so I actually want to share a scripture that I was studying today that felt relevant. And it's from Genesis chapter 30, verse 22. And it's at this point, Jacob has married Leah and Rebecca and both of their handmaids. And they're all having babies except for Rachel. Not Rebecca. Rebecca's his mother. But everyone's having babies except for Rachel. And she's devastated. And she's so heartbroken because Rachel is actually his true and first love. And she's the only one that's not having children. And there's a scripture here that says, "And God remembered Rachel, and God hearkened to her and opened her womb." And I love to put my own name there. "And God remembered Tess," or whatever your name is. And just look back in your life at the times that God has remembered you and rescued you and hearkened unto you and given you the things that you have righteously prayed for. So I love that.
It's so beautiful.
Yeah, you probably didn't think that that scripture was for Michaela today.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
We're awesome, and we appreciate it. So we'll let everybody go. Go look for those angels.
Thanks for joining us on Angels Among Us. You can find us on YouTube and wherever you listen to podcasts. Follow along for more stories of everyday miracles and reminders that angels are among us. If you have a story to share, please email or DM us with a brief summary. We'd love to hear from you. And remember, when we are waiting, God is working.